Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Revenue Ops and ABM Alignment with Pablo Dominguez. Hi, Pablo.
Hey, how are you doing?
All good. You know, when I was Googling you, I found the Mexican football players. So I didn't know if I will have the Mexican football player or the author of the book, yeah, like What a Unicorn Knows. So I'm very lucky that I'm having the author, actually, because you have a decade of experience in sales effectiveness, in sales operations, and now working in a company that day-to-day works with the CEOs in helping them in this sustainable growth, especially now with this all uncertain time. So pleasure to have you here. Maybe we can just dive deep and tell us what do you mean by sustainable growth?
Yeah, cool. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And interesting that you find Mexican soccer players. I am originally from Mexico, so that's great to see. I did play soccer growing up, but clearly I took a different career. So what we mean by sustainable growth is, and I think it's very applicable in today's environment, right, is are you able to build a business that is sustainable, right, that is going to last long enough to handle the ups and downs of a boom economy or a difficult economy, right? And have you built a business that, you know, where you can sell new business, expand into your existing business, and starts to be profitable, so you're not just relying on growth long term? So that's sort of what we mean by sustainable.
Yeah, I think when I was a kid, I was just on the fun note. I was big fan of Mexican soap operas, and Talia, like Marimar, all these were, yeah, like I even remember the songs, and you know, I suppose Mexico and also Europe or Eastern Europe, where I am from, they always had these businesses that were growing like really, really fast in a very short time, and then something changed in the economy or in the politics, and then everything went down. So for sure, those were not
sustainable,
yeah, right? So, but now in the tech world, funny enough, we see companies that that go down. That you know, we had this, we have all the layoffs and you know, growth at all costs, which we had prior the crisis. So I'm just wondering, like, how do you guys work in terms of, because you were mentioning it even on your LinkedIn that you're taking the CEOs hand by hand, and you guys are supporting them in that sustainable growth. So let's dissect a little bit this, then later on we can go more.
Yeah, and let me give the listeners some context also, right? So I've been in go-to-market effectiveness now for, oh boy, almost 25 years, right? I started my career in management consulting. I've spent some years in two different public companies, and then I went to a startup for 5 years, had a nice exit there. And then I've been at Insight Partners for almost 5.5 years. And Insight Partners is a private equity and venture capital firm that invests in B2B SaaS growth companies, right? So we're looking for high growth companies in the B2B SaaS place. We have over 500 portfolio companies, all ranging from, you know, you might be doing 1 to 2 million in ARR to, you know, over hundreds of millions in ARR. So it's a good breadth of companies. And so I'm responsible for the advisory team. And so Insight has, you know, obviously some of the best software investors in the world. And then we couple that with a team called Onsite, which is about 50 advisors around product, marketing, engineering, sales, customer success, talent, that are there to work with our founders and CEOs and their teams to help them scale their companies, right? And the team that we have is basically deployed to meet our founders where they are in their journey. So if you're zero to 10 million. You need things that are very different than if you're 10 to 100 million, 100 million plus. And so you're getting access to resources that have been there and done that for your stage of growth. Really no different than in a regular company when you're selling to a customer, right? You have SMB customers that are very small, then they graduate to mid-market because they get bigger, they go to enterprise, and you deploy different resources and products to them because, you know, a Fortune 500 company needs something different than a small business owner. So we tailor our solutions to work with our founders. And so when we talk about sustainable growth, obviously at zero to 10, a founder who is finding product market fit, starting to build go-to-market fit, hiring their first head of marketing, head of sales, you're trying to take the pitch out of the founder also, right? Because early on, the founder is the one who's doing everything, right? They're the ones managing the company, doing sales, et cetera. So you're trying to help them build a business that's going to be able to evolve from product market fit to strong go-to-market fit. And so as you scale, right, obviously a company at 50 million or 100 million or 500 million, it's the same strategy to help them continue to scale, but you're using different tools based on where they are.
Yeah, and as far as I understood, to be fair, I didn't read yet the full book, but I read the reviews. I read, I put it a bit into ChatGPT to, you know, some of your podcasts just to give me a summary of what the book is about. But the book essentially is also about sustainable growth. So did you write the book like prior joining the current company or before? And what was the motivation behind it? How did you end up with this topic?
No, it's a good question. So I've been working when I was at a public company, I met a man by the name of Matt May, who's my co-author. And Matt had been applying lean principles to manufacturing companies, to product companies. He'd been working with Amazon and stuff. And lean is all about optimization, right? And the removal of waste. And we started applying that to go to market, right? To sales, to marketing, to post sales, to really streamline how those organizations can take a customer from, you know, lead to cash. Right, basically the quote to cash process. And so I did that a couple of times at the public company. I did that at the startup I was at, had a lot of success. And then when I joined Insight, Matt also has joined Insight as with us. And so we wanted to put the principles into a document, right? Because we were working with a lot of our portfolio companies on, well, how do I leverage lean to improve my time to value, right? Or my implementation time is taking too long, or the sales process is cumbersome. So we had written some blogs and then had the idea, well, why don't we just put this into a book? Because no one's written about lean for go-to-market. And that's really what the book is all about, right? It's about how to apply lean principles in go-to-market so you can drive a sustainable business. And we have really relevant examples of companies that have basically done that, right? And what the best companies do. So the book was all about leveraging five principles that allow companies to build a very strong business based on, you know, strong strategy, strong experimentation, driving value for customers, leveraging lean principles, and then obviously tying that in with what we call esprit de corps, having a strong culture and a leadership team. And those five things combined are what help build a very strong business. And it's very relevant for those of you in revenue operations because you're in the middle of, right? Well, what systems should I use or tools or why are the processes, you know, salespeople are upset that it takes too long to get a quote or legal takes too long to respond or finance, or I've got too many steps in the process. So anytime you can remove, you know, 10, 15, 20% of that, that makes it easier for me as a rep to do my job, right? It makes it easier for the company to acquire revenue. And obviously more importantly, makes the customer happy because the customer doesn't want to be waiting to use your solution, right? That you've just sold them and they paid millions of dollars for potentially.
Yeah, and on that note, I would love to pick your brain a bit on go-to-market fit because nowadays, like with all these economical turbulences, we can see that we are back to square one in a way that we are trying to find a go-to-market fit. So even if you are like a Series A, let's say you're a Series A, right? Like let's go at the beginnings of a tech company, right? And you had that outbound motion, right? You had that outbound motion that worked in a way. You had the scripts, the cold calls, you were doing outreach, you were using SalesLoft, all the spiel with Salesforce and so on. But now you are in a moment when you say, okay, that push of growth, you know, like those ads and outreach and SDRs and reps and all those quotas and everything, they don't work anymore, right? Like, or they work less, they are not that effective. So how should one approach in a lean method with today's, you know, turbulences, a sustainable growth? Like what would be the what would be the steps to it?
Yeah, no worries. And it's like the way we would work with a portfolio company is twofold. One, have you mapped out the customer journey, right? What the process the customer is going through. A lot of times companies go, well, we fixed our processes, we streamlined, we're better. Well, the customer doesn't really care about your processes. The customer's on a whole different other journey. And so if you don't understand the jobs that a customer is trying to do, right? Because at the end of the day, the customer is buying something because they have to solve something that not having your product or somebody else's product doesn't allow them to solve, right? They're feeling a pain, right? Which is why we teach reps to sometimes sell on solving pain, right? And so if you understand and map out, well, what are the issues the customer's going through and how can we help them solve those issues? You can go back and say, okay, well, is the way that we're pitching, is the way that we are handling objections, is our value prop resonating with the customer, right? And because of the economy, things have changed. Maybe they don't care about the things you care about anymore. And all they care about is saving 10% more because they're getting pressure from the CFO.
Yeah.
They don't care about the extra features. They just want to save 10%. Maybe that's it, right? Or maybe they are willing to pay more if you're able to solve two more things for them, or somebody's trying to get promoted and they want to look good, right? So understanding what's motivating the customer to potentially look at something and making sure your BDRs, your sales reps are saying those things, your demos are tied to, you know, solving the issue versus just talking about the product, would be for step one, right? And so we call that sort of value mapping, right? So really understanding the persona, and then really mapping out what the jobs to be done by the customer and what does the customer really care about. And then once you understand that, then there's the internal view, right? So what is preventing us from being more effective? So for example, do reps have all the latest information on handling objections for their competitors? Right. So there's new competitors that popped up. So now when I'm selling to you, before I could very easily just sell you on value, but now you tell me, well, three other people basically pitched me the exact same thing. So what's the difference? And now I don't know what to say as a rep, right? That happens a lot. Yeah. So are you prepared to give reps material real time, right? Or are you leveraging AI to give you that real time so you have talking points so that you don't fumble in front of a customer, right? And so streamlining that process as well. So it starts with really understanding what does the customer now value, and are you prepared, and is your team prepared, and do you have the right team, right? So that's the other thing too with go-to-market fit is the team you might have had 2 years ago, if things changed, one may need to be reskilled, retrained, or upgraded potentially, right? If customers have changed and you don't have people that can actually convey the message, or you've decided to go more upmarket, right, versus downmarket. And so you might need a different skill set. So those are a couple of things I would say you need to look at.
Yeah, and I really don't want to talk about the portfolio companies because you guys can go online. You just go to insightpartners.com/portfolio. You can check it out, right? But what I want to understand from your view, at which stage as a company grows, or when should I start looking into a more enterprise motion, a more ABM motion? Because this is something that we get all the time. Like, you know, ABM is such a trendy word nowadays, right? Like it's a in my view, it was there all the time. You know, you have a list of companies and you just go after them. But it got sexy for a reason or another. Yeah, like some tech companies, MarTech pushed it a lot. Yeah. And it got sexy, right? But, and then we have small companies coming to us and wanting to implement, you know, the ABM motion. Now, from your experience, looking at all these companies that you guys have in your portfolio with all your experience, like what should be some kind of checklist or what should be some kind of questions you should ask before saying, okay, now it's time to implement ABM?
Yes, it's a really good question. And there's no, like, there's no answer that says like, hey, when you get to 20 million, go enterprise. Yeah. When you get to 50, go enterprise, right? There's companies that have gone to 100 million with pure PLG motion selling transactional, right? And have never gone enterprise.
Yeah, I just talked to Plio yeah. from Denmark. No, like they don't do ABM. They are an amazing big team of RevOps. I mean, like 20 plus teams in RevOps.
Yep.
Great demand gen on segmentations, subject matter experts on each and every industry, but no ABM. And I said, okay. So, and I was wondering, wow, I am amazed. How come? So, yeah.
Yeah. And it depends, right? Because it starts again with product market fit, right? When you build your product, you're thinking, well, who is this product for? Who's going to buy this, right? And how am I going to sell it? Is it going to be product led? Is it going to have product led with some sales led motion? Is it, you know, there's a lot of tools in DevOps that are community led, right? Where DevOps people and programmers are using stuff. And so eventually that turns into enterprise, right? And so I'd say first and foremost, you have to have very strong product market fit down market. Because if you don't have that, you're never going to be able to go up market. And by up market, I mean enterprise, right? And so if you're going to start to sell to the enterprise, one, you've solidified yourself down market. And so typically, you know, rule of thumb, you've been able to scale to 10 to 15 million, right? Once you start crossing 10 million, okay, you've built something that's starting to be sustainable. And then you start realizing, okay, well, I could capture more business by going up market, right? And so first and foremost, you need product market fit to also go up market. People think, well, I have product market fit for my down market solution. Therefore, it's going to be easy to sell to a global 2000 company, right? Well, guess what? If you don't have security, if you're not able to land a logo, a lot of those companies will look at you and say, I'm not taking my chances with a 10 million ARR company, right? I'm running a multi-billion dollar company. I can't afford for something to go wrong, right? So landing that first customer is super critical. And you'll notice that most companies, when they land that first or second customer, might be giving it away, not for free, right? But you're basically at the whim of whatever that large enterprise customer is asking for. And because that's your reference customer, right? So then the next customer goes, oh, you're doing business with SAP. Therefore, if SAP was willing to do business, and this isn't just some little company, right? And so there's an inflection point when your product is ready, the security is ready, you're seeing demand. But typically the way the enterprise motion starts is bottoms up. Right? Very few companies go to sell to a Fortune 100 company to the CEO, the CFO, the CIO. It usually starts with the department, right? You land in part of a big company and then you land in another department and someone goes, wait, what are they using? We want to use that. And then you land a large enterprise agreement where they say, well, hey, let's use it for all of SAP, right? So don't be fooled that you're all magically just going to go directly to the top and sell, you know, 200,000 licenses. That rarely happens. You start bottom up, right? And so the ABM motion is very important. And you're right. ABM has been around for, I don't know how long, right? Like it's just being rebranded and it's newer because there's better tech now, which is great, right? Now there's technology that allows you to really understand, are people interested in your product, right? And the whole premise of ABM is you have to be more targeted to larger enterprise customers, right? You have to meet them where they are. And marketing has to be very specific, supporting sales, but also post-sales in a much more customizable way, right? Versus when you're down market, you can be much more generic, right? In terms of how you market and how you drive demand generation versus when you go to, you know, selling to the Global 1000, the Fortune 100, You have to be much more targeted because they care about specific things. Decisions are made by multiple people, right? Not just a founder or a CEO or a CRO down market. You're talking to 15, 20 people, and the sales cycles are 6 to 12 to 18 to 24 months, right? So your marketing strategy has to be very closely aligned to sales, to nurture, and send very targeted campaigns, et cetera, to the company. So hope that answers your question.
Yeah, that's great. And I was just thinking while looking at your profile, I mean, you had, how much was it, ADP, 8,000 sales associates or 8,000?
Yeah, so I ran RevOps at ADP, and we had 8,000 sales reps, right? ADP, very large company, world's largest payroll player, right? Like I think ADP pays 1 in 6 Americans. You know, it's not just payroll, it's also human capital, but 8,000 reps globally, right? And all selling different products. So you can imagine the complexity of supporting that from a RevOps perspective.
Kudos to that. And I was just wondering when I was looking at this and said, okay, so this is my man to put the ultimate question about moving to ABM. So what we see in the market and a lot of companies do is they do demand gen, they do inbound, and suddenly they land with inbound or maybe PLG, some enterprise client. They said, woo, enterprise. Now we want to go after enterprise. And they do all the CEO, all the motivational speech, all the ops. Now let's change and do ABM. But then I then we see that the budget changes, right? Like the effort in actually doing ABM and going after enterprise. At what point it actually makes sense to go after ABM after you put all the metrics, right? And this is what I would like to know. What kind of metrics should I look at? How should I evaluate that shift, yeah, from that inbound PLG motion to enterprise? Like, because it's like different people, different competencies who would run ABM than the guy who run inbound, right?
Yeah.
Different budgets.
No, everything absolutely. It's completely different people on your marketing side, right? Because ABM is primarily more for an outbound motion, right? You'd obviously still leverage it for inbound, but if you think about, well, it's surprising because sometimes people go, well, ABM has to be outbound. There's no way Fortune 10 company is going to come inbound. We've seen Fortune 10 companies come inbound. And the question I always have is, how did that happen? Like, what are you doing that somebody actually from a Fortune 10 company like clicked on request a demo, right? Like, what was going on? But it can happen, right? Which is why both motions are important, right? If you're going to go pure enterprise, you don't want to ignore the inbound motion because people are looking for information, right? And with GPT and all the other AI solutions, though, those AI solutions are pulling from your website. So if your website is not providing the right information, the right demos, the right pricing, et cetera, whoever is searching at those companies for information is not going to get what they need, right? So let's park that for a second to make sure you don't just ignore having a strong inbound motion, right? But to do the outbound motion, you definitely need people that understand ABM, right? This is not just, let's design a good website. Let's make sure our SEO and SEM is working effectively, right? This is, what is the strategy to actually target these personas in these companies? What do they care about? What is the messaging? What's the value prop? Because it's very different, right? What I want to target for a CFO, the language has to change compared to the CIO, compared to the CRO or the CMO or even the CEO, right? You've got very different messages in terms of what you want. What you're also providing sales teams, right? From a marketing perspective on messaging with your enablement team has to be structured. So I do think if you're going to do ABM, ABX effectively, you need to have the right team within the marketing organization that may or may not be the team that did your PLG motion, your inbound motion, et cetera, because they are drastically different. No different than saying, well, can my mid-market rep sell to SAP? Maybe, but I'd rather take someone who's been selling to the Global 2000 for 10 years and knows the complexity, et cetera, because I'll probably have better odds, right? So having the right team that has the right strategy is super critical.
And would you say that the metric, the ultimate metric, would be just the deal value, or it's also the logos and the branding that can it bring to the company?
It's both, right? So from a marketing perspective, you need referenceability, especially starting early, right? So some of your objectives should be, can we land four or five logos that will be referenceable customers? Because once you have those referenceable customers that are successful, it'll be so much easier to land other enterprise customers, right? Once you've got that referenceability, I think the metrics should basically align. I strongly believe that marketing, sales, and post-sales metrics should be very aligned, right? I think companies that have that, you know, raise the flag that, hey, we won, we accomplished our goals, but ultimately the business didn't, you have misalignment, right? And so your goal should be, are you achieving the revenue targets or profitability targets that the company set, right? If you wanted to land 1,000 new logos, did you accomplish that, yes or no? Regardless of what you spent on marketing spend or sales, has we built X amount of pipeline. If you're not achieving the common goals and the metrics, it doesn't really matter, right? I'd look at conversion rates of ABX campaigns, right? Should we expect X conversion to you know, of leads to opportunities, and should those be closing more effectively? So, and also tracking which personas we're getting more successful with, right? If we're targeting the CFO, the CIO, the CTO, the CRO, the CMO, where are we seeing success, right? And making sure we put the dollars towards where the higher conversion ends up being, and making sure the reps know, like, hey, you're more successful landing here first, right? And again, going back to what I said before, test, like, do we do well bottoms up? PLG, where developers say, hey, this is awesome. Then a manager buys it. Then another manager buys it. Or do you sell directly to the manager and the department? And so figuring out the success rate there allows you to say, hey, we're really good when the developers just start using it and then a manager buys it and then a department, right? But over here in this industry, we're a lot better. We can go directly to a business unit and then multiple business units buy it, right? So that data will tell you where to spend your money on your ABX, and also on where sales should spend their time.
Yeah. And I was saying this a lot, like at the beginning, maybe you start an pilot ABX just for the logos, right? Or just even if you are not bringing that ROI from your first ABM campaign, because this is a marathon. It's not like you want to do first time ABM and you want to be fully having your ROI. Yeah. It doesn't work like that, because you're changing your team. You're making a huge transformation. You're bringing totally new motion in place. So at the beginning, make an ABM strategy. And this is where I see a lot of mistakes. People try to copy, I don't know, Six Senses ABM strategy when you are in Series A. It doesn't work like that, right? Like first,
100% agree. So by the way, in the book, our second chapter is about experimentation, right? And product teams are very good at experimenting, right? We've all heard about MVPs, right? They release and they iterate. They release and they iterate versus just waiting until it's perfect, right? And so I'd say if you're a Series A, Series B, and you want to try enterprise, don't shift your entire company to do enterprise, right? Test it. Have one rep start to do enterprise. Have marketing support that one rep and see, does it work? All right, this didn't work. Let's iterate. Before you say, okay, let's go hire 10 enterprise reps, 3 people in marketing, and go really deep on supporting them with an ABM, ABX campaign. Like, test it first to see what works and iterate. Once you start getting momentum, then you can double down and go a little bit bigger. Otherwise, you're going to waste a lot of capital on something that may not work.
Yeah, and there are, as you said also, there are companies like in DevOps. I know one company, this Git Tower, which is a simple, you know, development software for developers. And it's used by, if you go on their website, used like developers from a bunch of big enterprises, but they don't do ABM, and they will not do ABM because the PLG motion brings those logos, right? And it's fine. It's okay. You don't need necessarily to now, because it's sexy, to move away. And then, of course, I should be, you know, promoting ABM. It's the podcast, but some at some point, you know, it doesn't work. It's not good for you. So, yeah. But just to shift a bit to RevOps, because I was talking to Carol Chen from Flyware. She's doing RevOps there. And it's interesting, the discussion I had with her, and I want to take your, you know, ideas on this. You know, pre-IPO and post-IPO, like, how does the whole operation RevOps dynamic change? Because this is a similar, let's say, PLG to ABM, and now everything changes, and then pre and post IPO. I don't have personally experience in this, so I would love to hear your
It changes drastically. And again, having been in two public companies and then a startup, right, and I'm working with a lot of startups now, it's night and day, right? I mean, pre-IPO, yes, there's a quarter, but I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but it doesn't matter, because you're only answering to investors.
Yeah.
Right. And I say that carefully, it doesn't matter. It's very different when what you're answering to is the public markets, and everyone can see the results, and every move impacts the stock market, right? Every piece of news or change you make is drastic, right? Versus your pre-IPO, you're hiding in your house, right? Like, nobody cares what you do inside your house. Imagine if all your walls were down and your neighbors could now see inside your house. Like, you're going to behave very differently. So the expectations on RevOps also change drastically, right? The metrics and the KPIs you're tracking, you better be buttoned up, because they're exposed, right? And so you're running a much more well-oiled machine. It's almost like, you know, depending on what sport you play, it doesn't really matter, but like, going IPO is like, you're now on a professional team versus a high school team, right? It doesn't mean you're not going to work really hard in high school, but it's a whole different level of expectations once you're on a professional team, and right, you're playing with other professional people, right? Like, you're not in the big leagues. And so your team in RevOps is probably going to scale differently. You might be asked to do different things. Now you're reporting different things with finance that you weren't reporting on before, right? Sales capacity planning is now super critical, because every headcount counts, right? Because EBITDA and profitability is that much more scrutinized. It's not just about growth, and I'm not saying growth at all costs, right? But it's not just about sustainable growth. It's about long-term profitable, sustainable growth now, right? So it's exciting. I think for those in RevOps that go from pre-IPO or go to, you know, post-IPO, I think it's an awesome transition. The complexity is different. I think there's also a misconception that, hey, once you're post-IPO, it's got to be easier because you're a billion-dollar company and everything works. Like, let me tell you, like, public companies are just as messed up and have as many issues as a Series A or a Series B. It's just different issues, right? And sometimes you go, how is this a $100 billion company? Like, how could this even be working this way, right? But I think that's what makes it fun, is there's always opportunity to streamline and make things significantly better, which is fun.
What are the new roles that pop up at post-IPO in RevOps or in ops teams?
I don't know if they're new roles per se. I mean, obviously, like, there's like AI stuff might be popping up everywhere now, but I would say you're probably spending more time on enablement in larger companies, because, you know, 8,000 reps, you got to make sure they're trained, right? Back to your point around messaging and like value prop to customers. Like, if you don't have 8,000 people saying the right thing, you're not going to grow, right? So enablement is super, super critical. And I would say also systems, right? You know, we complain about, hey, the CRM's not set up correctly, I have 10 reps. Like, imagine if the CRM isn't set up correctly for 8,000 reps.
Yeah.
Right. So those teams are also working much more closely, and they're larger with IT to make sure, you know, your Salesforce, I remember our Salesforce instance went down once at one of the public companies, and we were on with Benioff. because you couldn't run your business. You have 8,000 reps that couldn't do
Makes sense.
Contracts, right? So it's interesting.
Yeah, and I suppose I come from learning and development from corporations, and then I transitioned to RevOps. So at my heart, I have, you know, the enablement, right? And I think when we talk about enablement, it's very important to, again, don't copy-paste. Like, have that... one, competency map is very important. So really map out what competence... I know it might sound very corporate, but what competencies you need at which buying journey and which deal stage? Because it might be... And again, for God's sake, let's don't put the SDR reach out to CEOs. Like, please, if that's possible. Because... It's peer-to-peer, right? At the end of the day. Like, we want to engage with people from whom we can learn and we can develop ourselves. Like, that's a human need that unconsciously we have it, right? So in learning and development, you need some kind of, like, if you reach out or do outreach, you need some kind of inspiration, right? So competency, having the right people to inspire in a way, to facilitate that buying journey, that's very important. So in as you said, Pablo, like enablement, that's like critical. But nowadays, going into AI, because this is where enablement becomes very interesting, right? Like the whole, the way we work, we shift. And unfortunately, there is no time to teach everyone how to use AI, right? Like, it's so fast. I mean, if you don't catch up, you know, you're not self-driven, then it's really hard. So just before we close, like, from what you see today, what are those examples of, I don't know, ABM or RevOps tactics or techniques that you saw out there that can help companies build a sustainable growth? Because I want to stay on this sustainable growth.
No worries. And I'm glad you brought up AI, because everybody's like, oh, AI. But I think there's a huge opportunity for marketing teams and RevOps teams to leverage AI to make their lives easier, right? Especially in marketing. Like, our marketing team here at Insight has spent a lot of time with our portfolio companies, teaching them on how to streamline building content, right? Landing pages that are customized when your prospect is coming, right? And so I know who you are, again, from an ABM perspective, right? If I'm using certain ABX tools, right, I can customize the landing page to your industry or your role fairly quickly with the help of AI, right? I can write blogs and tailor content specifically that I can send to you if you're a CFO or a CIO, right? So what used to take me, you know, maybe hours or days or weeks to customize, I can do in minutes, right? And so that allows me to refocus my time. And from a RevOps perspective, you know, the amount of time that reps spend doing research, preparing for a meeting, learning about their competitors, their prospects that they're going to go talk to, that information can all be made readily available, right? And to your point, AI is changing frequently, right? So what I recommend people do is have constant updates with your teams on a monthly basis at a minimum to let them know, here's the things you should be doing. Here's examples of, hey, again, going back to the jobs to be done framework, right? If you're a rep and you're trying to do this job, or if you're in marketing trying to do this job, here's the three tools or prompts that I recommend for you, right?
To embed AI in the jobs to be done.
In the jobs to be done, yeah. And so, and then again, update it in 30 days because everything's changing. And then have people also share, right? Because you might have a rep or somebody in HR that's doing it 10 times better than everybody else, and you don't want to lose that, right? So you want to have the community within your company also sharing how they are doing their job more effectively, and then turn that into a best practice. But you're right. For the first time in history, at least since I've been alive, like, things are changing by the second, right? Like you think you have a best practice and the next week it changes completely. So you've got to stay on top of it. Otherwise you'll get left behind. That's my feedback.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks a lot, Pablo. Like I loved it. I loved it. And, it was a pleasure to have you.
Likewise.
Tell us just, how can people find you, obviously on LinkedIn, but what are some, you know, other books or podcasts, episodes where they can learn more about you?
Yeah, no worries. Anybody's welcome to find me on LinkedIn. Obviously, my name's Pablo Dominguez and happy to connect and talk to people. And if you want to hear more about the book, you can go to whatunicornknows.com. And the first chapter's up there for free. I've talked about it in a couple of podcasts. So if you want to listen to those, you know, they can summarize. You can just Google it and find it. But yeah, happy to connect with anybody. And thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Thank you a lot. Take care, guys.